Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out at noon every Tuesday here on BCFM 93.2. This week, the People's Tribunal. But what People's Tribunal? We speak to Cheryl Corliss, who's a victim and a survivor of the care system. Also, a war game. It's all about the Second American Revolution. We find out about that too. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol just off Queen's Square on 0117 989 7733. And I'll repeat those details at the end of the show. But first of all, I'm joined by Cheryl Corliss on the line. Hi, Cheryl, and welcome to Dialect.
Hi, thank you.
First of all, tell us a bit about the People's Tribunal. I know you're a survivor of the care system. How come the People's Tribunal got started?
It was a mixture of survivors and professionals got together. And it was based on the Iran Tribunal. I think that happened last year, and that was a success. We just decided that enough wasn't being done to help any of us. It's like the government inquiry that hadn't started when we started, but there was talk of it. So we just all got together and just see if we could work something out ourselves to try and expose what's been happening in institutions for children all around the country.
Yeah, so how have you managed to... I mean, it's obviously... It almost sounds like it's the kind of thing that would start through pub talk where... And actually, not necessarily even just people who are survivors saying this, because there's lots of us out here who are concerned that the government isn't taking this seriously enough. Now, is that fair to say that you are just fed up? A little bit maybe like the people in Hillsborough were after a couple of inquiries, official inquiries have been done, but with no real results.
Yeah, definitely. We all met on Twitter, and that's how we started it. And then we had a talk about it with survivors and professionals, and then we were voted onto the steering committee and see if we could do anything. But that was last September, and then we officially started in December. And things have just they've got better and better as time's gone on. We're getting stronger and stronger as time goes on. I think people need to realise that not all answers are going to come off the government.
Well, I would suggest probably no answers unless they're absolutely squeezed out of them. I mean, by looking back at things like the miscarriages of justice in the Guildford 4, the Birmingham 6, long inquiries like the Chilcot inquiry into the Iraq war. We're talking about also the phone hacking scandal, which took a long, long time to have an inquiry into that. And then a lot of people, journalists particularly, are holding their hands up and saying, well, there's been no real change with Rebecca Brooks, the former editor of the News of the World, being put back in charge of another one of parts of Murdoch's media empire. So nothing really having changed there. And then what I said also about Hillsborough, it's a bit of an uphill struggle, I suppose. But also, you've got this thing hanging around in the background. Is you kind of, by asking the government to investigate this, it's almost like asking the government to accuse and find themselves guilty. It's almost impossible to do, surely, Cheryl?
Yeah, that's what the solution we came up with. I decided, even before the government inquiry started, that I didn't want to be a part of that. I've tried telling authority for years. I've got paperwork back from the 1980s where I was telling them what was happening.
Okay, well, look, let's just have a look at your story to begin with. That's particularly frustrating, isn't it? If you are being told now, oh, it's okay, you can go to the police and talk to them, whereas you've done that in the past and got nowhere. It must be quite a few people, not just you out there, Cheryl, saying, well, what's the point?
Yeah, well, the last time I rung the police was last October, and they came out, took a statement, and then I never heard from them again. And that's what happens every time I make a complaint.
OK, well, look, just take us back in your past to how old were you when this first started invading your life, and how did you react to it?
I was 15 when my mum put me in care. My mum, she's a survivor from the Irish care system. And that altered how she was as a mother. She wasn't the best of mothers, but there is an explanation for it. She put me in care at 15 on Christmas Day. And It was more the other people at first. They'd come out and they'd take the girls out, and we never spoke about it, but we knew that something bad was happening. And then the first
time
I was
can you tell us whereabouts you were at this point?
I was in Blackburn, Lancashire.
Okay, and what was happening?
The first time I was in, we was locked in 24 hours a day. You weren't allowed out. The school was on site. It was basically like a prison, really. Girls were taken out. Like, one example, one girl that was there, she was 13. She called herself a child prostitute. And a man used to come and take her out every Sunday, and she used to say that was a regular when she was out of care. And there was other instances like that, and...
It sounds to me as if this institution you went in, could you name it, please? And, you know, that this kind of thing was considered normal.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. That home I was in, it was called The Grange. It was in Wiltshire in Blackburn. And that was the first time I was sexually assaulted. And that was the day before my 16th birthday. I was put into a bedsit. They call it a bedsit. It was just a bedroom on your own. You weren't in a dorm anymore. And nobody ever wanted to go in there, and I never understood why. And then the night before my 16th birthday, one of the staff came in and raped me and told me he was going to make a woman of me. That was the only time I was hurt there, but it still traumatises me, even to this day. And then the next place we went to... I was 16 and I'd been locked up about 7 months. I wasn't a normal 16-year-old. I was very emotionally damaged. There, the staff encouraged us to get drunk and they'd take us to parties with various professionals from social services, and we would be offered drink alcohol and just get really drunk, and then things would happen. We were told it was a lifestyle choice. Some of the girls were being groomed by Asians in the area. Like, this was back in 1988, 99. That's how long the grooming scandal's been going on. And it was horrific. One of the nights, they got me so drunk, I could hardly stand up. And I came home, and some of the local lads were out, and I got gang raped in the garden of our home. And I was under the office window, and the staff shut the office window. They shut the window. And then the next day, they told everybody I was a slag, and they pinned up my ripped knickers and put them on the notice board to tell everybody what dirty slag I was. And I went to the police. That's in my paperwork. I went to the police, and it says dates in my paperwork in black and white. The police rang the home and said, Cheryl's coming here telling stories about you. You need to watch what she's saying. So It's like everybody knew, and it was just accepted. We were care kids. We weren't important enough for anybody to care or stop it. We were made to feel like we were below society's normal.
Yeah, almost like kind of, it's something a little bit sort of almost fascist about this. You know, it's like these people aren't real people, and almost like you're being used. But tell me how it affected you emotionally. It must have been horrific, Cheryl. And how did you cope with this as an individual? Did you manage to carry on with the understanding that this was wrong, and that there was something bad and maybe illegal that these people were doing to you?
No. I thought I must have deserved it. I ended up getting into a very violent relationship where my partner was physically and sexually and emotionally abusing me for 6 years.
Okay, so was that someone who was older than you and had come across you through this care home?
No, I ran from care. After I was gang raped, I ran from care. And I lived on the streets for a year after that.
Okay, well, how did you cope with that, for goodness sake? A year on the streets?
It wasn't easy, but it's in my notes as well. I was going to social services and asking for help, and they were giving me a phone number and saying, ring this number, they'll help you. But I was on the streets. I had nothing. I had no food, no money. And back in the day, like, do you know what I mean? We didn't have reverse charges, and it was awful. So by the time I met my partner, I was already broken. I didn't have any self-esteem at all by then. I just felt like, well, I must deserve it, or else it wouldn't have happened. And because everybody ignored me when I tried to tell them, Well, it must be something that I'm doing wrong.
I mean, that I find it's, you know, difficult to see, Cheryl, how, you know, you can get to such an extent where you think that you're to blame for continual criminal acts that are being conducted against you. How did you manage to hold yourself together?
At the end of that relationship, I ended up going into labour, and he started punching me while I was in labour. So I ran to the phone box to ring myself an ambulance, and I ended up giving birth in the telephone box. And that's how I ended the relationship. That's where I got the strength. But obviously, everything came back then. I think it was post-traumatic stress. And I was about 25 then, so everything that had happened over the past God knows how many years all come back, and I had a breakdown. But then social services took my children. Before they took my children, I actually went to the police and I said, I think I was abused when I was in care. And then they took my children and they said that I was delusional and I was making stories up about men in suits. Why would they want to rape kids from care? I was delusional, so I must have been delusional about the partner that was beating me up. So they gave him my children.
Well, that must have been even more of a blow.
Yeah, it was just reconfirming all the time that I wasn't worth it. I wasn't worth anything. Do you know what I mean? It was. And then the year after that, one of my sons was forced adopted. The year after he was adopted, Operation Nevada started up in Lancashire. And they got in contact with me and they asked me if I knew of anything about abuse and care system in Lancashire. That it was too late. That they took my children. They destroyed everything. They'd taken everything. And so I wouldn't engage with it. It was like, well, you didn't believe me when I needed you to. It's too late now. You've taken everything. I've tried to research Operation Nevada since, and from what I've seen, nothing came of it.
During this time, was there anybody that you could trust?
No. My mum, she just kept telling me I was brain damaged and imagining things.
I mean, sure, you know, surely you must have come across some people.
Some people. And yeah, it's like they've come across my fight on social media, and like people that I've known from my past, and they've like, I remember you saying about that. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't until 7 years ago when I met my sister-in-law Gemma. She's also on the steering committee. She suffered abuse as well, but hers was in the family. When I met her and we got close, we realised that, no, it wasn't us. It wasn't anything we did. And then 5 years ago, they took my new family, my new children away. And this time they said they took them because I was abused in care. And because I was abused in care, I was at risk of emotional harm in the future. And
You know what's the biggest emotional harm is taking someone's children off them.
I know, it's just a fight you can't win, and it's made me feel like we were left to be abused so they could take our children in the future to keep the system going.
Yeah, well, I mean, hopefully you still have managed to find some resources from somewhere to carry on, otherwise you wouldn't be part of this People's Tribunal, Cheryl. What's your situation now, then?
Now, I haven't seen my children for 5 years now. But I am waiting for a court date for two of my sons to apply for contact and residence. Social services have totally turned around, but that's since I've been working on the People's Tribunal. They've realised that, yeah, well, I'm not what they say I am. Do you know what I mean? It's my children is the only thing that's kept me going.
But I mean, you haven't seen them for 5 years. You say you're not allowed any contact with them at all.
No, the youngest two are forced adopted. They're together, and then my 10 and 11 year old, they weren't allowed to see each other or any other family member for 4 years. They've just seen each other this year for the first time in 5 years, and that's only because my MP wrote to the chief executive at the social services and said, "Well, why are you keeping these siblings apart like this?"
Okay, well, what about legal stuff, though? Because if you're going to be part of a People's Tribunal, you need a bit of legal advice. Have you managed to get that?
Yes, we've got Alan Collins. He's known as the best child abuse lawyer in the country. He's our legal advisor. He's fantastic. He's a lovely, lovely man. He's totally committed to the cause. And Regina, she's our chair of the People's Tribunal. She's a barrister in America. And she's fantastic as well. She's done everything she can to help us in every way going. And the judges, we've got a bit legal with the judges as well.
What difference has it made, the whole revelation over Jimmy Savile a couple of years ago? Because I would have thought that what was once upon a time, you could almost pull the wool over people's eyes and say, oh, well, this person's a fantasist. Has there been a real change, do you think, since? Because Jimmy Savile was someone who was very well known, actually quite powerful, very friendly with royalty, with Margaret Thatcher, the Prime Minister, someone who's very high up in society, to have been proven to be the worst sexual abuse offender that Britain has ever known of, to be in that position, suddenly makes these things, at least on the surface, appear more credible.
Yes, I have seen a shift. Up until Jimmy Savile, everyone just thought me and Gemma was the crazy ladies. We were talking nonsense.
Why is that? Why do people assume that you're talking nonsense? What is it in people that makes them assume that someone isn't telling the truth when they're talking about their experience like you have done?
I don't think they want to believe that the care system isn't good. The society as a whole, we've been made to believe that the care system is there to protect children and do the best for children. And I think it's hard for people to actually believe, if they haven't suffered it, I think it's hard for them to believe that people that were supposed to be caring for children really didn't.
So why were people in the care system, working in the care system for social services, running these care homes then? What was their real motive?
It's anybody's guess. Personally, I think most of them was there because there was no CRB checks or anything in them days. I think personally half of them worked there to get to children. The statistics for children in care that end up in prison and on drugs, and it's crazy. It's really
the cruelty of the carers, I seem to remember reading as one of the Daily Mail headlines. Would you classify the people that were running your care homes as cruel people?
Oh yes, definitely control freaks. We weren't allowed to leave a room on our own. If we wanted sanitary products as young women, we had to ask for them. And do you know what I mean? And if we ran away, we'd have to have a bath in front of male staff. And that was just humiliating. That was really humiliating. And even now at 43, I can't bear to be naked in front of anybody.
I mean, have you managed, do you think, to turn your life around to become relatively, I hate to say, use the word, but more normal, Cheryl?
Yes.
How have you done that?
3 years ago, I had a massive mental breakdown. And I sought help through the mental health team. And I was diagnosed bipolar with post-traumatic stress disorder. We had a bit of a shuffle around with medication and everything. And then we found something that works for me. And that keeps me stable now. And I've changed as a whole person now. It's... I don't have to think about that. It kind of blocks away everything from the past away now, so I can focus on being who I am now. And the People's Tribunal, it's helped me no end. I think I'll get closure with the People's Tribunal because I've gone out and tried to help other people who suffered. I think I'll be able to finally shut the door on it and just get on with a normal life and just be normal.
Well, that would be nice, wouldn't it, after some of the stuff you've been through. What is the People's Tribunal up to at the moment?
Right now, we're just fundraising. We finished taking submissions in August. We've hired all the judges there already. We'll be going to meet them on the 3rd of October. Now, at the minute, we're just fundraising. We need to pay for... We're having a public forum in January. That's where all the findings will come out, what the judges have decided. So we need to hire a venue for that. And we're also doing a documentary as well that's been following us around, how we've done it and how it's come about and our stories and everything. So we need to fund that as well. So it's all really just fundraising at the minute and getting media attention. But the media, they're they're still at the stage where if it's nobody famous, it's not important, and that's really, really hurting a lot of survivors. It's like saying that because Jimmy Savile was your abuser, your abuse was more important than that person who Joe Bloggs abused. And it's very damaging to the cause. It's really, it's not very nice to people who have suffered. We've all suffered just as bad. Nobody's story is any worse than anybody else's, really.
What about the official inquiry? I think it's the Goddard inquiry it's being called now. It's the third person who's been in charge of it. I'm reminded a bit of Princess Diana's inquest, because the first two coroners that were chosen to conduct Diana's inquest too refused to do it. And we've had the same sort of thing with the official inquiry. Can you see how some people would say, well, actually, there's no point in having a people's tribunal running in parallel with this official inquiry?
I can't see why they say that, but I believe that the people's tribunal will uncover more and expose more than the government inquiry. Like, we've done it with no funds whatsoever. We all work for free. We always will work for free. We've done it with no funds, and we're going to be finished 18 months from when we first started. Whereas the government inquiry, I'm hearing it can be 5-8 years now or something.
Well, the trouble is, of course, that by stringing it out like that, it's a little bit like the Chilcot inquiry into the Iraq war. If they're fingering particular people that should be sent on trial, charged, etc., then they may be dead by the end of it.
Exactly. And plus it'll be the next election by the time, do you know what I mean? It's just passing the buck, isn't it?
So anyway, how do people contact the People's Tribunal, Cheryl, and donate or else possibly, you know, because of course the other thing is, you know, you're also looking for a bit expertise and possibly venues, if people are able to offer you a free venue, that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah, that would be amazing if we got offered that. Our website is ukcsapt.org.uk. And we have a fundraiser going at the minute. That's on Give Forward. And if you just search UKCSAPT in the Give Forward, that'll bring us up to us. Basically, we just need to get the word out now, really, and build up a momentum ready for the public forum in January. Raise enough funds to do it. We've got the people. We've got an excellent team of judges.
I notice there's also a phone number, which is 07549 228377 for the People's Tribunal. That's 07549 228377. And I think what I'll do, Cheryl, is also give that number at the end of the programme too.
Thank you.
So, Cheryl Corliss, from the UK Child Sex Abuse People's Tribunal, the website, ukcsapt.org.uk, phone number 07549 228377. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Hello, I'm Angela Balassi, and I will be speaking to Peter Ellis, who is the secretary of Chandos Road Traders in Redland and an organiser of the Bristol Conquer Championships. He's calling for someone in Bristol to conquer the world in the next World Conquer Championships. He wants to bring the game back into fashion, saying it's the last art because of health and safety. Hello, Peter. Thank you for joining us.
Hello, Angela.
So firstly, tell me, why do you want to bring the game back?
As you said, conquers is a lost art. It's the beginning of autumn. And as a child, I used to play it, and hundreds of us used to play it. And now you don't see people playing it anymore. And I think it's a lost art that needs to be brought back.
And do you think health and safety has got in the way?
I think that that's a bit of a myth, an urban myth, I suspect. The high vis and goggles and helmets that people said are, from what I can gather, an urban myth. No, health and safety is not an issue. Our Conquer Championships will have no health and safety issues whatsoever.
And could you tell me a little bit more about your championships?
Yes, we'll be playing to official World Championship rules, and we are the only Conquer competition to have a guaranteed entry for the winner into the World Championships. They take place on the 27th of September, and it's a straight knockout tournament, with the winner, as I said, getting a nice trophy plus guaranteed entry to the World Championships. We want a Bristolian to win the World Championships.
I understand there are other incentives as well, like is it Michelin-starred meal?
Yes, there's
well?
Meal for two, a meal for two at Wilkes Michelin-starred restaurant for the winner as well.
Okay, great. And so why is Chandos Road Presents, why is it organising this event? Well, it's a street fair as well, isn't it?
It is. We felt that Chandos Road has a original feel to it, a more village feel to it, and we want more people to find out how wonderful Chandos Road is. So we put on every year, we close the road, we invite the public to come along, see the many fantastic businesses that are on Chandos Road, have some, hear some live music and do some fantastic events like the World Conquer Championship, the Bristol Conquer Championships.
And you're a letting agent. Is it a case of it will help also trade in the area? And
We hope so. We have two new businesses just moved into Chandos Road, and they'll be hoping to gain something from this as well. Yes, we are a close-knit community, but we like to let the world see what we have to offer.
And going back to the Conquers, what exactly are the rules?
Quite simple. Firstly, we will provide the Conquers, though no baking your Conquer or soaking it in vinegar. Two, it's 5 minutes. It's three shots each alternately. If in the 5 minutes your neither Conquer is broken, we go to alternate shots and the most number of hits wins. And every round you get a new Conquer. You have to hold the Conquer no more than, you have to have 8 inches of string at any one time, so you can't make it small to get it closer. And no stamping or snagging allowed.
Are you a regular Conquer player yourself?
I must admit that my Conquer days are probably beyond me, but and I shall be the official referee, so I can't enter this tournament, unfortunately. But maybe if someone else takes over the mantle in the future, I would like to enter.
And what skill is required for the game?
Good hand-eye coordination. And a steady and a steady hand as well.
And can anybody take part?
Anyone can take part. Unfortunately, if you are under 18 and win, you can't enter the World Championships, but we are open to anyone, any age, any sex.
And are there any tips or advice you'd give to would-be conquerors?
Focus is important. It's like any sport, whether it be any sport where you have hand-eye coordination, keep your eye on your target.
And are you worried that anybody will get hurt?
We'll have first aid on hand just in case.
That's great. And once people get, or if they get to the World Championships, what's at stake there?
The honour, mostly. A very nice trophy. The Conquer necklace, which is awarded to the champion every year. And the knowledge that you have brought glory to the city of Bristol.
And how long will this game go on for? I believe there's 32 entrants, is that correct?
32 entrants, straight knockout. It should last a couple of hours. We've sort of worked it through. There'll be multiple games going on any one time.
How do people get involved?
They can visit our website, which is www.aul.org.uk/conquers.
And could you remind me, please, of the date and time when it's taking place?
The 27th of September from midday at Chandos Road Presents on Chandos Road.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Is life a game? Well, some people certainly do behave as if it is, and one of the things that's been, certainly since the First and Second World Wars, been learnt by the military is that the most likely way of winning a war is to treat it like a game. So hardly surprising that in the United States, since World War II, there's been a big explosion, really, in the amount of money spent on wargaming, and some of those wargames have been turned into commercial wargames, which have been sold to the public, others not. This is, in fact, one of the places where the virtual reality simulations have been developed that have led to the modern types of video games, most of which are utterly hideous, of course, probably best avoided with all the blood and guts. But game theory is quite an important part of all this, and you can look up lots of things about game theory, but it is, what is game theory? It is the study of strategic decision making. Specifically, it's the study of mathematical models of conflict and cooperation between intelligent, rational decision makers. Well, this is the kind of stuff that fits nicely on a computer nowadays, but back in the 1970s, most of this kind of thing was done using tabletop board games. One of the companies that did that was SPI, Simulations Publications Incorporated. They have been based in the West Coast and in New York at various times, with people like Jim Dunnigan and others being their game designers. But I've always found this quite interesting. The way that they started games and putting them together was they'd start with a kind of brainstorm. In order to look at ideas about how a conflict might come about. Now, the games produced by SPI over the years have included all sorts, including things like Napoleonic warfare, right the way through First World War and Second World War, and modern. For example, one of their most popular games was called The Next War, which is looking at a war in Europe erupting. But they also did things which they call future history simulations. And one of the interesting ones I want to talk about today is this one called Minuteman. Now, Minuteman is subtitled The Second American Revolution. Because what they've done is they've sat down and said, well, where could we have a kind of war game to do with a revolution and how it might be coped with. And I just want to read you out now some of Jim Dunnigan's notes from this game, because I think it says quite a lot about in the 1970s the way they thought in the States that history might unfold, and has unfolded now in the 35 years or so since. So they call it The Enemy Within. Shortly after the turn of the century, between 2003 and 2014, remember this is written in 1976, a number of profound changes took place in the United States. The oil and other non-replenishable natural resources were running low. Alternative energy sources were not coming online fast enough to take up the slack. The enormous public debt run up during the latter part of the 20th century was now causing severe disruptions of the national economy. Externally, America had fewer problems. Russia had nearly bankrupted itself merely to keep pace with the Western powers in an arms race whose only benefit was a de facto renunciation of war and a preoccupation with internal affairs amongst the major powers. The Third World, on the other hand, had divided into the Third World and the Fourth World. The new Third World consisted of those countries which were economically capable of supporting themselves, and in particular were able to produce their own food or raise enough cash to buy it from the US and Australia. Canada was no longer a major figure in the world grain market, since the climate in the northern latitudes had shifted, ever so slightly, in the cooler direction. The shift was just enough to wipe out most of Canada's grain export surplus. The economic hardship thus created in Canada did little to ease the economic situation of the US or the Fourth World countries, which were for all practical purposes starving to death. But no one mentioned starvation. The Fourth World nations were at least able to prevent themselves from sliding into complete anarchy. Food was distributed and rationed to the point where population was being lost on a massive scale due to disease. No one wanted to admit that anyone was starving. Thus, the world was at peace, but the various individual countries were not. The Fourth World and the richer countries were sufficiently isolated from each other to prevent the direct contact which had often led to major wars in the past. Thus, was the United States able to concentrate on her own considerable internal problems. The growing scarcity of raw materials had driven the prices up on many heretofore cheap and abundant commodities. In addition, the trend of the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer had been accentuated. The only jobs that paid enough to provide comfortable existence were to be found in the government, military, and the top 100 industrial corporations. Because of the vastly increased mechanisation of work, the top 100 corporations employed only some 10% of the working population. The government employed only another 12%, but some half of these government employees were non-listed employees. These were basically patronage jobs, and the workers served at the pleasure of the elected officials who paid them. Another 4% of the working population was in the armed forces. The armed forces had become something of a hereditary institution. The pay of the soldiers, particularly of the NCOs and the officers, allowed the average serviceman to live quite comfortably in comparison to non-military fellow citizens. To get into the armed forces, one applied for membership because the number applying far exceeded the number of positions available. Acceptance into the military was also contingent on being the relative of somebody already in the military, or being otherwise deserving of some favour from the government. The net result of these three developments, the large corporations, the government and the military, was to concentrate the good-paying jobs in only some 20% of the working population. Some 50% were either unemployed or vastly underemployed. The government now provided millions of public works jobs, which, because of mismanagement early in the programme, had now become nothing more than another form of public welfare. Little work was done and just enough money and food was provided to keep the recipients alive. The police, which amounted to about a third of all government employees, were kept busy seeing that over 40 million unemployed and underemployed men and women did not get out of line. The remaining workers in America were kept in check through a carrot-and-stick approach. On the one hand, there was always the promise of high-paying jobs in the corporations or the government, or even careers in the military if they didn't cause trouble. On the other hand, there was always the threat of banishment, the never-never land of unemployment or make-work jobs. What had been keeping the country quiet for 20 years of this ever-worsening situation was primarily hope. Hope that a solution would be found that would bring back the golden age of the mid-20th century. The golden age had been an era primarily of hope that always seemed to be on the verge of fulfilment. The present situation was not one in which Americans were starving, nor did they lack most basic comforts. What they were denied was any great hope of improvement. All that was now offered was the minimum necessary to keep oneself alive. There was no challenge and no future, only a prospect of this becoming a permanent situation. This was beginning to dawn on many citizens. The one thing that probably triggered the Second American Revolution more than anything else was the Educational Aid Act, passed in 2012. Remember again, this is written in 1976. The ostensible purpose of this act was to provide a free university education for deserving Americans. And as it goes on and on and on, what they've done effectively, I think, in the 1970s is predicted quite a lot of what would happen today. The idea of mass unemployment and the American dream turning sour. And in the game, you get really to play out the idea of various people in an underground movement overturning the government of the United States in a kind of second American Revolution. So what's the point of all this? Well, I suppose it's interesting to think in the 1970s already they were gaming this kind of stuff behind the scenes, and that's what they were telling the public and selling this game to the public called Minuteman, which was a throwback to the Minutemen of the original revolution. Anyway, I'm joined by Angela Balassi now to discuss something, I suppose, which is a bit more up to date, which is the Corbynistas and the advent of a new kind of Labour Party over the last few weeks. What's your first reaction to this, Angela?
Well, I think there's been a mixed reaction. So there are some that are clearly in support of Corbyn. And we've seen from the headlines, there are those that are mostly against him, and he can, you know, simplest behaviour or not acting or not doing something, such as singing the national anthem, has gone very much against him.
What are your thoughts about the way the media's reacted then? And I mean, you would expect in a democracy with a healthy media that if a decision has been made to change things, well, the media would just have to stomach that.
Well, I think there's been criticism of Corbyn for not singing the anthem, but as it's been pointed out, he would have been criticised either way had he not have sung it. And the headlines have been mostly attacking him. So we've got, for example, Corbyn snubs Queen and country, and this is a Daily Telegraph. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, he's a Republican, isn't he? Actually, I'm a Republican too. I mean, I just think we've got a particularly bad royal family. I'm not, you know, vehemently Republican, but if you had a decent royal family that were a bit more honest and less underhand, then that would be better. But I think in a way it's good that you've got someone who's saying, well, funnily enough, I don't really believe in the monarchy, and so not singing God Save the Queen. I noticed Dennis Skinner was on Twitter tweeting something about what is God going to save the Queen for? Because she's got everything. She's got everything anyone could ever wish for. Thousands of palaces. So what is the actual meaning of God Save the Queen?
Well, also the Metro have gone with Not Save the Queen and said, shameful, Corbyn refuses to sing national anthem. And that's from the Daily Express.
Well, look, and the next verse of the national anthem is God Save Our Noble Queen. Well, if she was a noble queen, she would have replaced the criminal people running Jersey who've been putting young kids in, basically in torture chambers, sectioning them and leaving them isolated, and also overseen a horrendous rule of sexual abuse at the Hôte de la Garenne Children's Home. Many people in Jersey, including families and people who've been abused themselves at that care home, have been writing to the royal family saying we need some to you need to replace the people who you appoint to run Jersey, and they've refused to do that. So that's not very noble.
Well, on the flip side, Corbyn has been praised for his prime minister's with the question time. Some people said that it was, I think the Guardian reported it as his calm, non-confrontational approach. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think anything would almost be better than what was before, because the Ed Miliband question time was, it was bizarre, and the Harriet Harman one was bizarre, because what the Labour Party spin doctors seem to be asking, I mean, I just wonder who's really running the Labour Party in opposition when you've got that kind of thing going on, the spin doctors advising and elbowing the leader of the opposition. They were asking the same question again and again and again and again. I think they get five questions, don't they, the opposition leader? The same question five times, to me, is a waste of time. You need to be asking five different questions. It seems to be a bit of a no-brainer to me. So I know one of the things that Jeremy Corbyn said he was going to be doing would be taking questions also from Labour Party supporters and members of the public as potential questions. So it seems really interesting that rather than having the political apparatchiks telling him what he should be asking questions about, or advising him anyway, he's throwing that open, and we're saying it's a people's question time.
Well, he's also been criticised for that. The Independent headline was, "Is there a spin doctor in the House?" And there is this idea in some of the press that he should have a more coherent media message.
Well, I think that's probably true, because, I mean, as you and I as journalists know, there's quite a lot of spin goes on behind the scenes. I know Dennis Skinner a couple of days ago was interviewed live outside the House of Commons by Emily Maitlis from BBC's Newsnight, and she began her piece by asking him live, were you disappointed not to be included in Jeremy Corbyn's cabinet? And Dennis Skinner, bless him, explained very clearly to everybody that he'd contacted Jeremy Corbyn when it looked like he might become the Labour leader a few weeks or months ago, to say that he didn't want to be invited. He would rather stay as a backbencher, because that enabled him to carry on in his very independent, shall we say, maverick style of being an MP, Bolsover MP, the beast of Bolsover. And at the end of the piece, it was quite interesting to see Emily Maitlis then did a piece to camera after she'd finished interviewing Dennis Skinner, saying, well, that was Dennis Skinner who's turned down a post in Jeremy Corbyn's cabinet, or worse to that effect. Anyway, this is absolutely verbatim, but that's effectively what she said. And you could hear Dennis Skinner in the background screaming, well, making a big fuss about it, saying, well, you're already spinning. That's not what I said, is it? And so, and he came back on camera and corrected Emily. And so I think and then you could see him storming off in the background. So, you know, these sorts of things on live television do show you the amount of pressure there is on journalists like Emily Maitlis to actually get it right. I mean, it might be that she was just reading off an auto cue, but there's lots of things that go on behind the scenes when it comes to political interviewing that viewers and listeners don't necessarily see.
So do you think Corbyn would be well placed to have a spin doctor?
Well, if you have a look at one of Tony Blair's great successes, is that he had Alistair Campbell behind him. I mean, many people actually think that Alistair is a war criminal because of his involvement with the Iraq War and the death of Dr. David Kelly. But one thing you can say about Alistair Campbell, he was extremely good at getting the Blair message out to the public, the thick of it. Comes to mind, you know, the dramatization of that kind of spin doctor way of doing things. But I think, you know, definitely Jeremy Corbyn has got to have a good someone who really knows what they're doing in that job, someone who's on side with him politically, knows the message he wants to get out, and is able to really facilitate that. And I don't think we've necessarily seen that. I'm not sure. Over the last few days, someone else might have been appointed to that job. But that is going to be a crucial part of the new government. Opposition is whether they actually managed to get their message across with effectively quite a hostile media.
Well, on the other hand, we have the Times. The sketch writer Patrick Kidd said, "Well, perhaps he, Corbyn, should be commended for a lack of hypocrisy." Do you think it's a case that maybe people appreciate the openness of Corbyn? Maybe that he seems honest.
Well, it's certainly a different brand of politician, isn't it? I mean, there are certain things that bring people into politics. I think most people are attracted to political parties because they want to change things for the better. And what often happens, though, is that they realise, well, the way to become an MP, the way to progress once you have become an MP, to become possibly a minister or a shadow minister, and then into some of the high offices of state, is to be obedient and pliable. And that seems to sort of squeeze a lot of the life out of people who've become interested in politics and become politicians even, because they have conviction. And definitely Corbyn is a conviction politician rather than a career politician. The thing that worries me most, though, Angela, about all of this is that we've now got people who are not just looking at getting one of the top jobs, you know, becoming a Secretary of State on a massive salary, or a minister on a bit of a less salary, or maybe Foreign Secretary, one of these big jobs. But they're actually looking beyond that at what jobs they can get in big business once they've finished. So, say, for example, in a Defence Secretary job, looking at taking jobs as a consultant or a director of one of the big arms manufacturers when they leave office. And once people get ideas in their head about doing that, then the public just get left behind, and the decisions that they're making in those key jobs then become really based around the idea of making their future employers happy. In other words, doing arms deals that are useful for future employers, that kind of thing. So I think Corbyn is definitely not that kind of politician, and we've had far too much of that from all parties in the past. This is basically the revolving doors syndrome, where you get people coming out of business into politics, out of politics into business, and you can't really tell the difference between the two. They're basically in politics to sort out nice contracts for their employers.
Well, Corbyn has been heavily criticised by several cabinet ministers for his refusal to sing the national anthem, and a Labour spokesman has said he will sing the national anthem in future. So do you think they've already started that process of making him more pliable?
Well, it's almost like trying to fit him into a box, isn't it? But it's very difficult, I think, to persuade somebody that it's a good idea to sing a song about the Queen when they're actually a Republican and they don't believe in that. And I think if Corbyn stands up to that pressure, but there are a lot of people out there who will respect him for it and say, well, you know, actually we had a civil war in this country in the 1600s where the King Charles I had his head chopped off. And I think it was the 31st of January, 1649. So, you know, I think that the idea of a monarch there as a token person is okay. It's fine. But when they start basically getting upset because a prime minister has not sworn some kind of fealty to them, like you know, some kind of feudal vassal, then that's taking the powers of the royalty much too far.
And do you think it's hypocritical for Corbyn then to accept an invite to the Queen's Privy Council?
Look, the question here is who's in charge. The Queen is one of the richest people in the world. She's also got power networks that run right through this country. And in fact, she may be the richest person in the world because a lot of her wealth is hidden in tax havens. Funny that she doesn't want to close those tax havens down, and in land which is not declared around the world. So being in the Privy Council, I mean, there are what exactly is the Privy Council? Of course, this is another question. What it is supposed to be a I think it's every single Secretary of State who's has always been invited to join it, and its offices are, I think, at number 13 Downing Street, next door to number 10 Downing Street, or just down from, maybe it's number 12, I'm not sure, but they're in Downing Street. So this is where a lot of the top civil servants get together, with the monarchy, with the Prime Minister, with the senior people in the country, and they have a little chit-chats about things. Now, I would much rather that those chit-chats, if you want to call them that, were done in public, because that's, I think, how a good democracy should function, with far less secrecy than we have under the constitutional monarchy.
And what do you think the future is for Corbyn?
I think he's going to be surrounded by what I like to think of as the Corbynistas, which is a play on the Sandinistas from Nicaragua, who were the socialist rebels. Well, they weren't actually rebels. They were an elected government. And they were much hated by the United States, who did Oliver North and various other criminals who were let off by George Bush Sr. did deals to get guns to the paramilitaries that they were sponsoring in Nicaragua to go around basically burning, pillaging, raping, killing, because they didn't like the way that the Nicaraguan people had voted. So, you know, there are people out there who I think are fairly pro-socialist, pro-peace, who will be really supporting Corbyn all the way. And I think we'll probably see this term, Corbynistas, unfold, because you have to look around the world to see other parts of similar movements going on, and Britain's no exception. I mean, we are just about still a democracy, and so if more people in the country decide they like Jeremy Corbyn, he may well win the next general election, just because of the fact that he's speaking from the heart rather than a career politician who's reading from the script, shall we say.
And do you think he can win over the press?
That's going to be a bit more difficult, although, of course, it's important that the Labour Party play their role in making sure that they kick up a fuss if partisan people are appointed to run the BBC. This is the most important part, really, the state broadcaster, because at the moment the Conservatives have put in charge of that this woman, Rona Fairhead, who's basically a criminal. I mean, she's from the Risk Committee of HSBC, which has been done for money laundering in the United States, billions of pounds they've had to pay in fines. And many people would argue that the new chairman of the BBC herself should be in jail, because there's a court case against her in the United States reported last year by the Daily Mail. So I think we need to have a bit of a robust response, and I'm sure that will happen with the new shadow cabinet, against the this criminal tendency which seems to be taking over the BBC. The other vice chairman of the BBC is one of the directors of BAE Systems, the arms manufacturers. So the idea of having criminal money launderers and arms manufacturers running the state broadcaster just seems like it's waiting for the Corbyn people to criticise it and to make some big changes.
And given the varying headlines, do you think it's possible for the press to be unbiased?
No, no such thing as unbiased press, really, Angela. You and I both have our own biases. I mean, we might like to think we're unbiased, and we can certainly give both sides of the story, but I think every single journalist that's ever existed has always had some bias, so to pretend otherwise is a bit silly.
Okay.
Okay, well, thanks very much for having a... Well, I think you should say thank me, really, because you've interviewed me, haven't you?
Thank you, Tony.
All right, thanks, Angela. That's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast, broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Peter Ellis from Accommodation Unlimited, and also Cheryl Corliss from the People's Tribunal, the number 07549 228 377, and the website ukcsapt.org.uk. Thanks to Angela Brennan and to Dave Bazenko. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week, goodbye for now.
take some beating, pop pickers.